This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
From Joy 94.9 Community Radio, this is the Joycast of The Fool and the Opera. In this Joycast, you'll get to hear an exclusive extended version of the weekly feature interview.
The Fool and the Opera with Dan Vo.
I'm very lucky to be joined in the studio by opera star and international jet setter Jonathan Summers. Jonathan has graced the stages of the world with his deep and resonating voice, the Met La Scala. He's a regular guest at the English National Opera and, luckily for us, Opera Australia as well. What excites me about his work is the fact that he likes to dabble in the dark side as well. There's Rigoletto, my favourite villain, Scarpia. You've got to roll the R's.
Yeah.
And he's in Melbourne to play Iago from Othello. Thanks for joining me, Jonathan.
It's a pleasure.
When Verdi wrote the opera Othello, he placed so much importance in the character that he was considering actually calling the opera Iago.
So I believe.
Yes. Yeah,
couldn't do that.
Do you find pleasure in playing the villain?
I do.
Yep.
Yeah. There are many shades to this villain. He's a flawed villain, but there are many facets and parts of his character to be explored and teased out. And luckily for me, I've done it a number of times, so I've always been able to come back and revisit it and look at it again.
So there's the deceitfulness and the deviousness in Iago, which is quite obvious, and it's quite desirable as well, I find. But there's also a
really,
lot of, yeah. But there's also the charisma. Iago is actually quite a charismatic character.
Well, yeah, it's interesting though because he's really what you would call the arch villain, and he lusts for power. And anybody that lusts for power, you can say what you like, they're up to some sort of mischief. They've got to be. He's perhaps Shakespeare's most evil of characters, and you have to realise that he is a Shakespearean character. And Verdi, I think it must have been his dream to actually make operas of Shakespeare's wonderful plays because they were absolutely masterly. And he managed it, I think, only three times. He managed it early on in his career with Macbeth, and then he managed it with Othello, and also with his very final opera, Falstaff, for which he adapted several of Shakespeare's plays to flesh out the central character of these in the character of the fat knight Falstaff. And can you believe that I also understand that he was working on a libretto for King Lear, which actually never eventuated.
Right.
Now, that would have been something something interesting that we can only dream about. But I think we're really lucky that he did do the penultimate Othello and the ultimate Falstaff, particularly when he did them too as an older man, because he'd been writing music, particularly opera, for when he came to write Othello for, I suppose, about 50 years.
Mm.
So he was an old man in his 70s, and he knew exactly what he wanted to say and how he wanted to say it. And in this character of Iago, he manipulates everybody. He's and nobody knows it. That's the point. He takes advantage of all of their trust, and he uses their own motivations and their weaknesses to achieve his ends. So that, and nobody knows this, and so he plays on their friendship and their trust to do all these dreadful things that he does to them. And ostensibly, until it all comes unravelling at the end, he's everybody's friend, everybody's mate.
Mm. There's an aria that you sing in this particular opera, which I'm quite taken by, which is Iago's Creed.
Yes, yeah.
Do you want to talk about the psychology behind Iago's Creed?
It's interesting that the Creed, because in the Shakespeare there is no credo, no creed. And there's a reason behind why Verdi wrote something which Shakespeare didn't in fact write. And the difference, I think, is between words and music. With the Shakespearean play, upon which Verdi's librettist wrote the story for him, there are a lot more characters, and it's a lot longer. And when you get to the opera, all of the extra characters who aren't essential to the plot are cut away. Now, Shakespeare's the wordsmith, so he's using words in a way that Verdi would write music. So he needs the length and the breadth of his drama, his tragedy, to be able to show all of the characters in all of their dimensions. There are lots of asides for Iago where he addresses the audience with his direct thoughts. There are all of his implicit thoughts which come through with the various scenes, so that if you were to actually put all of those together, those asides and those scenes, you would have the credo.
Right.
And Verdi puts the credo right at the start of Act Two, at the start of all of Iago's devilry and chicanery.
So what we hear is just basically the culmination of all of Iago's inner thoughts, basically. We get to see right inside his mind.
Exactly, and it's straight to the audience
in
a very Mozartian way. Mozart did it with Papageno, for instance, and he's always just turning to the audience and addressing the audience. The thing that Shakespeare didn't have was music. Verdi writes the music in such a way that the music becomes a subtext, and the length of action is not necessary, because he manages to create pictures in sound of the way we feel, of our emotions, and of the way not only we feel, but the way that the characters feel, the way that the characters feel about the action, the way that the characters feel about themselves. And there's this wonderful subtext which is bubbling along under the surface, which puts the characters in their context in a rather brilliant way. And I think this is the genius of Verdi's Otello, compared with and contrasted with Shakespeare's Otello. They are both absolute masterworks. One, because of the way he uses the words and the action and the way he's created these amazing characters, and with Verdi, because of amazingly brilliant music which he has written to put these characters in another, almost like another whole dimension altogether.
I understand that with the music, for example, you can hear the way that as Otello gets more and more jealous or furious, the music kind of has that same tone as well. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly.
This opera has been sort of, in doing my research for it, it says that many musicologists regard this as Verdi's greatest and most mature operatic work. Would you agree?
They do say that. I think probably you would have to say that. Because compared to I love the ultimate work, Falstaff, which I've also performed many times in both the baritone roles, both the jealous Ford and the fat knight himself, Falstaff. And I love those two characters.
Yep.
But and the opera is just absolutely masterful. But I think it's the tragic element of the Otello. It's interesting, isn't it, that he picked for his last opera a comedy,
right?
And his last lines to us all is, "Life's a big joke. Just enjoy it while you can and laugh a little." That's the final line of Falstaff, and that was virtually Verdi's exit from writing music, was that wonderful line that he threw away. So I suppose, yes, all things considered, he was like 50 years in experience at writing, and writing at his absolute best in his 70s, and cutting away, not putting in anything extra, not leaving in any gaps. He used to write furious letters to his friends about the way singers took liberties and put in extra notes, extra top notes, and long bits and pieces and little frills and fiddly bits that singers were wont to do. But in Falstaff and in Otello, he wrote with an extreme brevity that nobody could actually add anything to. It's absolutely wonderful. And the way he just rips straight into the opera with a blare of brass, ripping the curtain away, just exposing it all to us, dispensing with the traditional overture or prelude or anything like that. He wrote a wonderful prelude to Rigoletto, but there's no prelude to this. It's just like up, open come the curtains, and we're right in the middle of the storm. Just absolutely wonderful. So it is, I think so. I think I'd have to agree with that.
Fantastic. Let's talk about the rehearsal. When you put on the costume,
yeah,
do you all of a sudden take on the persona of Iago?
Interesting you say that, because I'm a bit of a fanatic as far as that's concerned.
Okay.
And it starts from, Geraint Evans used to say, it starts with the shoes.
Right.
Depends what you've got on your feet.
Okay.
And I like to actually get into costume from day one. And when we did this, this production was first staged in 2003, and I couldn't wait to get the costume on. And I didn't wait until we got onto
the stage. Very fetching costume as well.
Yeah, yeah. And I just wanted to get it on and get to work. And in fact, they're used to me now. And in fact, we've been rehearsing this in Sydney, because the giant set that we work on is set up there in the Marrickville Town Hall. And it's very difficult to find spaces to actually rehearse, because I don't think I'm giving anything away by saying that this set is like a hill of stairs. And you really need to work it. And it's dangerous.
Right.
Incredibly dangerous, very effective, because not only does it go up, but it rakes from one side to the other. So as you're facing the stage, it's higher on the left than it is on the right. So it's going on the slope from left to right, as well as going up the stairs. So it's pretty daunting, not for the faint-hearted, and you need to be fit. So when I got out for rehearsals out to Marrickville, sure enough, bless their hearts, stage management and the wardrobe department had my costume there for me. So I'm the only person who climbs into their costume to work, mostly just for my, just because that's the way I prefer to work.
Okay.
And I've got a lovely pair of long boots, look like a bit like a stormtrooper, really. It's something like, it's something out of Nazi Germany or fascist Italy or something like that. I did a funny thing the other day. I was in a bit of a break, and I had my full costume on, including the hat. And I went and stood with my arms folded on the steps of the Marrickville Town Hall,
right,
looking out on Marrickville Road, and did I get some stares? Of all places to do it, down in Marrickville. But no, I, in fact, I'm so fanatical about this particular set and about the dangers of this set that I actually go and work out on the stage at the half-hour call. If we start at 7:30, I'm usually on the stage for 15, 20 minutes, up and down, warming up, just getting used to it all over again in costume, because it's all about being confident. And, you know, when you're walking downstairs yourself, you hang onto the handrail and you look where you're going, not on this set. It's got to look real. So there's no looking at the steps. There's no hanging onto the handrail. And Iago, being the arch villain that he is, moves like Quicksilver.
Right.
He's there all the time. It's a wonderful challenge, and I love it. With these masterful characters, you don't have to, all you really have to do is dig around a bit into the character and be truthful to what the composer wrote. Do a little bit of research, if possible, to go in behind the characters, like the obvious research that I've done for this is actually to read the Shakespeare all those years ago. And I've been doing this role now for getting on for 20 years in various productions. And just listen to the music and listen to what your colleagues are doing. There's so much to be learned just from actually performing it with a range of people, and also directing it with having it directed by a different range of people, and also working with a range of conductors who also bring tremendous experience to it. So it's all there to be found, and with the great masterworks, particularly like this one, it still remains there to be found. You never get to the stage, well, personally, that is, I've never reached the stage where I have exhausted the possibilities. I know I can't go on performing this forever, but if I could, if in the hypothetical instance I was to, say, be condemned to be performing Iago for the rest of eternity, I would never, ever plumb the depths of the character of this of this person. And the way it was written, firstly by Shakespeare, and then with the music of Verdi and his Boito, his librettist, there just seems to be something always new, and it changes every time you go onto the set with a new director, new conductor, and a new range of characters. You find things, you find brand new things every time, and I find this so exciting because it makes performing every night. It makes performing something new. Although I know the motivations, I know my words, I know my music, and I know the production, it sets you free to find new things each time you go on the stage. So it's all about the wonder of live performance. It really is live, and it really is immediate. And to a certain extent, there is a brand new creation every time we do a performance. And if it all comes together. It's a miracle.
We've just come from rehearsals. Is there something from today that you've learnt that's new?
As an example, today I've learned to be adaptable.
Right. What does
because,
that mean?
Well, because they open tonight with a Butterfly.
Yes.
Now, and Butterfly has water on the stage, so it's a huge swimming pool affair, which means that when Butterfly's on, they have to have this all set up in the morning.
Mm.
Because it's this lovely kind of floaty thing on water. So we have this enormous set, this hill of stairs, which takes over the whole of the stage. And all that they could provide us with for this, and we have to have the set because the rehearsal time here is limited.
Mm.
And there are 60 plus members of chorus on this set at any one time, particularly in Act 1 and Act 3. And we have the set up on the rear stage at the State Theatre. And unfortunately, there is only enough room for what I could say about half the set.
Right.
So you have the steps going up to the top, where there's a big patio affair, but no steps going down at the back. So we all had to be very adaptable today.
You have to put on your parachute.
Yeah, so we had to sort of manage to sort of contrive our way up the sides of the stairs to get at the back ready for an entrance to come down. So that was fun.
Or you could have just done it on the Madame Butterfly stage and, you know, get yourself ready for that big battleship scene to start.
So, yeah, we learned to be adaptable today and everybody was good natured, but we're glad that tomorrow we'll get the full set and we'll get the real thing.
Now, there's some amazing singers who have done this particular role, Iago, Lawrence Tibbet, Tito Gobbi.
Yeah.
How do you sort of recreate the role and make it new?
There is an element of actually digging deep within yourself to find something. And now that's a challenge. And so there has to be a fair bit of soul searching and digging within, reading, looking into the text, talking about it, listening to other people do it, and I do that quite often, to find something new. I wish that I could have seen Lawrence Tibbet do it, because I think he would have been wonderful. Mum and Dad saw him here. I think probably it would have been in the 40s because they never stopped talking about it. He used to give concerts. And I have a recording of Tibbet singing the dream sequence where Iago beguiles Othello and fabricates this incredible lie which virtually drives Othello mad. And I've got a lovely recording of Lawrence Tibbet doing this with Ramon Vinay, and it's what I aspire to with this particular scene. I've listened to lots of singers do it, but nobody does it the way Tibbet does it. He observes all of Verdi's markings. He sings a wonderful, wonderful soft singing, which is really, really well supported. And it's just so delicate and wonderful that you can believe that Otello would fall for it, hook, line and sinker, as he does.
You mentioned your parents.
Mm.
Shall we talk about young Jonathan?
Why not?
Was it their love of opera that inspired you?
Which is their general love of music, generally. Mm. I think they were just music lovers. Mum was a musician in the family. She learned piano. She played the organ. and she had her own piano. Her dad bought her a piano in way down there in Tassie, in the when she was, oh, I suppose, about 10 or 11. She was a wonderful pianist, and she was my first accompanist, bless her heart. She was wonderful. And it was the encouragement of my mum and my dad that actually encouraged me and my brothers to do something musical. I'm the only one who sort of kept it up, and for whom it actually did eventuate into something. But even I didn't believe that that could have happened, being a good old Melbourne boy and growing up in Melbourne in the 50s and the 60s.
Yes, in McLeod, I hear, as well.
In McLeod High School.
That's right. We're both Northerners.
Got that. A couple of other singers from McLeod High School, you know.
Oh, right. Okay.
John Vegner.
Right.
Another one. And one of our guys who's actually singing, who's singing the part of Ludovico, the consul, Shane Laurentiev. He's also from McLeod.
Oh, fantastic.
And I have the feeling that Nicole Yule,
yes,
who's actually singing Butterfly tomorrow night, is also a graduate of McLeod High.
Oh, wow.
I stand to be corrected, but that's pretty good going for old McLeod, isn't it?
Yeah. It turns out that, you know, the North Side does turn out some good eggs after all.
Well, there you are. Yeah, and I came from Rosanna. Beat that.
When was it that opera actually became the great passion? For, you know, because you just said that it didn't destined.
I never thought that anything like this would happen to me. My teacher, Bettine McCorn, always had this idea in her head that I could make a career of it. As a boy soprano, I had a reasonable voice, and Mum said that when my voice settled down, she'd find me a teacher. She found Bettine. I went to sing for her, and she took me on as a student, aged about 18, I think I was. And we went through all of the voice production things, and she corrected my production and gave me a love of music, and more importantly, a technique which has lasted a lifetime, which you can't want for more from a singing teacher. But I was having too much fun with all stuff on the side, you know. I cut my teeth on the stage of the Heidelberg Town Hall as a pop singer.
Right.
Way back in the 60s. I was like the resident Tom Jones cover. I sang It's Not Unusual and Delilah and the Green Grass of Home and all of that stuff. And we had a rock band as well. It was the Sid Palmer Big Band in those days. It was a dance which was run by Billy Glennon, who's still with us, well into his 90s.
Right.
He lives out there in Warrandyte in the bush with his lovely wife. And Bill used to run several dances around Melbourne. And Heidelberg Town Hall, I was invited to go along by a friend from church, and they said they needed some bouncers.
Oh, right.
I was only 18, and my young brother and I, who was sort of 16, 17, he was like a big six-footer, you know, Lindsay. And we went there to assist in crowd control in the 60s, because Heidelberg Town Hall was the place to be. I mean, top of the middle of the Saturday night, the place was just absolutely shoulder to shoulder, and with people dancing to the music. Mm. And they did a really good show. Anyway, this friend from church let it slip that I could sing. And apparently they were looking for a singer. And Billy Glennon said to me one night, he says, "Hey, you could sing." I said, "Yeah, I sing a little bit." He said, "Would you like to sing for us?" I said, "Okay." So I went and sang something like, oh, golly, it was like Born Free or something like that, the old Matt Munro hit. And they offered me a job. And I worked at the town hall and learned how to work in front of an audience for about the next 7 years or so. And at the same time, I was involved with a gospel group which was based at the Rosanna Baptist Church. And this particular gospel group was based on music from black gospel in America. And this group is it's changed its format slightly, and the music isn't as sort of solid black gospel as it was. This was the original Proclaimers, and the Proclaimers, this is the Proclaimers before the duo that called themselves the Proclaimers, and we always regret that we never registered the name so they couldn't ever use it. But the Proclaimers was a gospel group of about 30 or 40 youngsters, with a rock band and a Hammond organ.
Right.
And we did some amazing stuff. There are there are records of ours still available locally out in the public domain that we recorded with Ron Tudor and Fable Records. And we toured all over Australia. We made records, concerts. And it was a fantastic experience for these bunch of kids, and we still get together every now and then to sort of reminisce.
Yep.
And at the same time, of course, I was doing singing competitions, and there are lots of singing competitions, or iSteadfords as they call them, all over Australia, which discover young talent. And I did my first competition at Hartwell. And then I think that same year I entered in a couple of the competitions at the Dandenong Festival,
right,
and was successful there. So that there was always a possibility, but I never thought anything much of it. And but later on, after having with all of these, my musical experience being educated in these three very, very different areas, I entered the main singing competitions in the mid-70s. And
this is the Sun Aria,
yeah,
and the Adelaide Estead.
The Aria competitions in all of the capital cities, really, Adelaide, Melbourne and Sydney and Canberra as well. And I won them all, as well as scholarships associated with those. And they kind of propelled me and my wife, Leslie, and our young baby daughter, Miranda, who was a one-year-old, all over to the UK for further study, not knowing what would happen next, or fully expecting for the money to run out and then to come home and probably restart all over again. But
so it was a big risk.
I made the right connections over there and auditioned for the Kent Opera that was then, and made my debut as Rigoletto, my world debut, in 1975. And we've been living there ever since.
Mm. So you've been all around the world. You've been on many stages.
Yes.
Have there been memorable ones?
Yeah, there have been. I think probably my debut at the Royal Opera as a junior principal in 1977 was amazingly memorable performance. And also my debut at the Congress Theatre in Eastbourne on the south coast as Rigoletto in that wonderful first Jonathan Miller Rigoletto, the one that came afterwards that everybody knows him by, the sort of the Chicago Mafioso one, actually had its roots in this original production,
okay,
which he did for Kent Opera. And then I suppose I'd have to say that the ultimate was to actually make my debut with Opera Australia. And that happened at the invitation of Richard Bonning, who was music director at the time. And it was to sing Papa Germain in La Traviata, opposite his wife, Dame Joan.
Yes.
And New Zealand tenor Richard Grieger singing the part of Alfredo. And I think that was pretty special. And two others, I think one of the main highlights at the Opera House would have had to have been my first Bohèmes there. And it was in amazing company. It was Iliana Kotribas was the Mimi. It was Giacomo Aragao as the Rodolfo, and it was all conducted by Carlos Kleiber, who was just amazing. And on the strength of that, I also made my debut at the Met. And at that particular occasion, Carlos was conducting again. And in the cast was Luciano Pavarotti as the Rodolfo. Musette was Barbara Daniels. The Mimi was Mirella Freni. And the cast just goes on. And it was just one of those dream experiences. It was wonderful.
Have there been some spectacular slip-ups that you remember?
Spectacular slip-ups. Now, here's the most spectacular slip-up I can think that comes to memory. Anybody who knows any productions of Saint-Saëns, Samson and Delilah knows that the climax of the opera happens when Samson pushes down the pillars of the temple and everything comes tumbling down. I did a production of this for Opera North, and we had 8 or 9 performances, and the cover, who was a very good cover, I might say, He could have gone on very well. And the thing is, they planned to put him on for the last performance because the Samson wasn't able to do all eight performances. So the cover was to do the ninth, which would be his one performance. Well, we got near to the entrance of Samson in the last act, but the high priest decides to bring Samson out for a bit of sport and make a bit of fun of him. Just before Samson made his entrance, there was a false fly cue and the columns splattered all over the stage. Well, I thought, now this is a disaster. What can we do? So they brought in the curtain. Stage management got on the stage and had a conference with the mechs, with the stage mechanics boys, and they decided that there just wasn't enough time to put them all back together again.
Right.
So they said, okay, let's go. So they pulled the curtain out and went on. What they didn't do was tell the guy who was coming on, the Samson, who was doing his one and only performance, that there were no pillars for him to pull down.
So what did he do in the end?
Well, he got there onto the stage all of a sudden and the penny dropped that he was going to have to improvise, and improvise he did. Oh, it was an absolute disaster. It really was.
You also used to work for a broadcaster.
I did.
Yes.
Yeah.
ABC.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I was what was classed then as a radio operator with the ABC. I'd always had an interest in that sort of thing, and I was like between jobs and not wondering which way to go. And we, with the Proclaimers, did a series of three specials for the ABC Religious Department. And the director, guy by the name of Fred Maxian, I got to know very well over that. And he said, what are you doing with yourself? And I told him, and he said, you should come to work for us. And I said, what do you mean? He said, the ABC is just the most wonderful organisation. He says, it doesn't matter where you come in, you can plot your way through it to go exactly where you want to go.
Mm.
And so I joined as a radio operator, signed on and did 5 or 6 weeks on-the-job training with one of the operators, and then was let loose into the radio networks, where I worked for Radio Australia. I worked in the home networks, which was 3LO and 3AR in those days. Then I did my stint up in the dubbing and editing suite, recorder they called it, and then in the various production studios, and there was a lot going on. That was in the days when the ABC actually ran all of the symphony orchestras, and out in Waverley, at the Waverley Studios, Studio 325 was where the MSO had their base and where they rehearsed and recorded. And so I did my stint on the production roster as well, and learned how to do all of that side of things. And then they threw me out onto the OBs, and Melbourne Town Hall was a favourite place, because before the concert hall was the concert hall, the MSO's base in Melbourne was the stage of the Melbourne Town Hall. So there was a permanent operator's booth for the ABC up in the gods, and so I learned to work in there as well. And then they, after 2 or 3 years of this, they thought that I had a little bit of go, so they threw me onto the relief roster.
So did sort of with the ABC, the experience that you had of recording concerts and that sort of thing, did that eventuate to giving you some sort of inside knowledge when you went to record your own?
Exactly right. Yeah, you couldn't have said it better, because I'd always been interested in the technical side of production from the operator's side of the glass ever since I was a kid. So I was a bit of a hobbyist as far as recording is concerned, and with the Proclaimers, several of us were responsible for actually setting up our own sound system and buying our own equipment and making up thoroughly good outdoor and indoor sound. So to have this professional experience of what it was like for the operators to actually have to deal with artists was a tremendous experience for me, actually, as a budding performer. I mean, I wasn't really a budding performer by that time, because I'd done a lot of work with the choir. I'd done a lot of work at the town hall doing the pops and so forth. So, and I was having this Almost like a foot in both camps, as it were. So, and when I actually came to the time of having to do recordings, recordings of opera for disc, which I did quite a lot in London in the early days at Covent Garden, I felt as if I knew everything about what was going on. I understood what these guys were having to do. I understood about how to use a microphone, the kind of techniques that are required. So I didn't know it, but it taught me a heck of a lot, really did.
Is it a different sort of feeling that you go through when you're recording? Is it? Do you find it more nerve-wracking, or do you still have nerves when
you
perform?
Yeah, I think every performer has nerves, but it's how you deal with it. I don't think I could deal with it if it was so debilitating that it made me fearful. And I know some performers who are like that, and I think if I was like that, I would give it up. But the nerves give a kind of an added tension to the performance, but you know that once you get out there that something automatic kicks in, and there's a little guy who sits up on the top of your head there and pulls the strings almost like the autopilot, and he kind of directs what's going on. But nerves are always necessary to give you the right kind of tension to do a proper performance.
Mm. Well, I was thinking before that with the role of Iago, if you did a really good performance of Iago, you'd actually, when you went for your curtain call, people would actually boo you.
It happens.
It happens?
Oh, yeah. Especially when there's kids in the audience.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, it's great. I love it. Yeah, it's really good. It does happen. I always take that as a compliment.
Yeah.
I think every time they boo, or if there are a few boos, I think, well, it must have been a pretty good one tonight if they're free enough to do that.
Excellent. Well, Jonathan Summers, if you hear a boo from the gods at your opening night, that'll be me booing.
Please do. Big loud one, please.
Thanks very much for your time.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Joycast of The Fool and the Opera from Joy 94.9 Community Radio. You can find more Joycasts and the program blog at joy.org.au/The Fool and the Opera. The Fool and the Opera is produced by Dan Vo and Jed Gilbert, thanks to the support of Joy's sponsors and members. Please help support it by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.